At the time of our lesson, Israel was in deep trouble. We read in Judges 6:1, "And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian 7 years. At one time, Midian was friendly to Israel. It was to the land of Midian that Moses fled after having killed the Egyptian taskmaster. Jethro, priest of Midian, became his father-in-law. Jethro and Hobab, his son, were good friends to the Israelites during their wanderings in the wilderness. Their descendants, the Kenites, were later united in close union with the Israelites. But over the years, Midian had degenerated into a vicious and warlike nation. They were a nomadic people, living in tents and shifting from place to place, plundering as they went. They are described as possessing cattle and flocks and camels as the sand of the seashore in multitude. Through plunder and tribute, they became very rich. When Moses was still alive, they began to demoralize the children of Israel and cause them to sin against the Lord by setting examples of immorality and idolatry. Because of this, Moses was commanded to break the power of Midian, which he did. The booty the Israelites took on that occasion was tremendous. This is the nation which, at the time of our lesson, had recovered and resumed its vicious ways and was again oppressing Israel. Their method of oppression was particularly frustrating. Rather than open warfare, army against army, they systematically robbed and plundered the Israelites using hit-and-run tactics. They watched and waited until crops were planted, cultivated, brought to maturity, and harvested. Then, when all the work was done, they swooped down and took the produce. This is indicated in Judges 6:3. "And so it was when Israel had sown that the Midianites came up. In the spring, they waited until the grass of the field was green and high, and when they saw the flocks and herds of Israel feeding on the lush grass, they drove down their own tremendous herds to completely eat up, fatten on, and destroy the pasturage. Like locusts, they denuded the earth. And afterward, they drove off the livestock of the Israelites together with their own." Thus we read in Judges 6, 4, and 5. "And they encamped against them," Israel, "and destroyed the increase of the earth, and left no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep, nor ox, nor ass. For they came up with their cattle and their tents, and they came as grasshoppers for a multitude, for both they and their camels were without number, and they entered into the land to destroy it." When the wheat had ripened and had been harvested, the Midianites watched from the hills for the telltale signs of threshing and winnowing. In those days, the ears of wheat were placed on rock-hard threshing floors, and oxen were used to tread out the grains. Then, on a windy day, the wheat was tossed high into the air so that the wind would blow away the chaff. This was hard work. During threshing, these clouds of chaff were visible from a distance and were observed by the Midianites. As soon as the hard labor of the threshing and winnowing of a particular field was finished, down came the raiders and seized the grain. You can well imagine the frustration of Israel. So in order to have bread to eat, they were compelled to do their threshing under great difficulty, in concealed places such as dens and caves, in which places they also hid some of their grain and such produce as they could salvage in order to provide skimpy rations. This is what is implied in Judges 6:2. "And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel, and because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made them the dens which are in the mountains, and caves and strongholds." I wonder if these were some of the caves which later were used for the storage of sacred scrolls. As a result of all this, Israel lived in constant fear and dread. They were a crushed nation. Now what was the evil which Israel did in the sight of the Lord, for which they were delivered into the hand of Midian? It was because of their idolatry, specifically Baal worship. And all the misfortunes they suffered were in strict accordance with God's expressed law to Israel. This law was expressed over and over again in their scriptures, clearly setting forth the rewards for obedience and the penalties for disobedience, so that no Israelite could claim ignorance of it. For example, we read of the blessings of obedience in Leviticus 26:1-6. Ye shall make no idols nor graven image, neither rear you up a standing image, margin, pillar, neither shall ye set up any image of stone in your land to bow down unto it, for I am the Lord your God. Ye shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. I am the Lord. If ye walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and do them, then I will give you rain in due season, and the land shall yield her increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. And your threshing shall reach unto the vintage, and the vintage shall reach unto the sowing time, and ye shall eat your bread to the full, and dwell in your land safely. And I will give you peace in the land, and ye shall lie down, and none shall make you afraid. Because of their idolatry, they were missing all these blessings. Instead, they were oppressed and beaten down. They were not able to stand up before their enemies. We read further regarding this expressed rule of God in Deuteronomy 11:25-28. There shall no man be able to stand before you, for the Lord your God shall lay the fear of you and the dread of you upon all the land that ye shall tread upon, as he has said unto you. Behold, I set before you this day a blessing and a curse. A blessing if you obey the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you this day, and a curse if you will not obey the commandments of the Lord your God, but turn aside out of the way which I command you this day, to go after other gods which ye have not known. This is exactly what they had done. They had gone after Baal and had incurred the curse. Now in Deuteronomy 28:15-33, we get right down to specifics. But it shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe all his commandments and his statutes, which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee. Then many curses are listed, and one of them is in the 33rd verse. The fruit of thy land and all thy labors shall a nation which thou knowest not eat up, and thou shalt be only oppressed and crushed away. Doesn't that sound familiar? This is an exact prophecy made many years before of what had come upon Israel at the time of our lesson. With this background, we now read from the narrative in Judges 6:6-8. And Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried unto the Lord. And it came to pass, when the children of Israel cried unto the Lord because of the Midianites, that the Lord sent a prophet unto the children of Israel. This prophet reminded them of their sin of idolatry, the cause of all their troubles, implying that if they returned to the Lord, they would be delivered from the hand of Midian. From what transpired next, we know that Israel must have listened to the prophet and indicated a willingness to return to the Lord. But they didn't know how to proceed. Baal worship was too strongly entrenched, and they had no effective leadership. So, seeing their willingness, the Lord provided the necessary leadership. We now read from the account in Judges 6:11. And there came an angel of the Lord and sat under an oak, which was in Ophrah, that pertaineth unto Joash the Abiezrite. And his son Gideon threshed wheat by the winepress, to hide it from the Midianites. A more accurate translation tells us that Gideon was beating out some wheat inside the wine press. The Jewish wine presses of that time were hewn out of rock and consisted of two large receptacles, or vats, at different elevations, one above the other. The upper and more shallow part, usually slightly below ground level, was where the grapes were put and trodden to press out the juice. And the still lower and deeper vat was a vat into which the extracted juice overflowed. When the lower vat was full, the new wine was ladled out and put into huge ox skins to ferment. After aging, the wine was transferred into smaller skins for use and for storage. Since the grape harvest did not coincide with the wheat harvest, the wine press was empty at this particular time. Gideon was inside the wine press, apparently in the lower part, where he would be completely hidden from the view of any Midianites who might be watching from a distance. He was using a flail, a wooden paddle, to beat out the wheat, and then he probably tossed the wheat into the upper part of the wine press to separate the chaff. It is significant that there was an oak tree overspreading the wine press. This would serve to conceal any emanation of chaff which might result from Gideon's efforts. The record says that an angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak tree. From this position, the angel was probably able to look down into the wine press. Gideon soon became aware that someone was watching him. Looking up, he saw a distinguished-looking man in bright clothing sitting under the oak. As Gideon quickly vaulted out of the wine press, his visitor stood up and greeted him with the words, "The Lord is with thee, thou mighty man of valor." This salutation seems a little incongruous. Gideon, in fear of the Midianites, had hidden himself in a wine press to beat out a few grains of wheat to make a little bread for his family. Did this make him a mighty man of valor? But I am sure the angel was not mistaken. He did not speak idle words. So this salutation must tell us something regarding Gideon's previous activities, something which the recorded narrative does not reveal. Who then was this Gideon? We know that he was a mature man and had children because Judges 8:20 refers to his firstborn son. We also know from Judges 8:18 that he was of a princely appearance, that he had the look of nobility and resembled the child of a king. So, although the record is silent on this point, I think we can reasonably conclude that he was already an outstanding man in Israel, that on many occasions he had valorously distinguished himself against the roving bands of nomadic robbers who oppressed Israel. Also, it is significant that Gideon did not protest or contradict the angel's reference to his valor, but only questioned the other part of the statement, "The Lord is with thee." We now read from the account in Judges 6:13 and 14. "And Gideon said unto him, O my Lord, if the Lord be with us, why then is all this befallen us? And where is be all his miracles which our fathers told us of, saying, Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? But now the Lord hath forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites. And the Lord looked upon him and said, Go in this thy might, and thou shalt save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent thee?" When Gideon addressed the angel as "my Lord," he did not realize it was an angel of the Lord he was talking to, but thought it was a man, a prophet sent of God. And now in his response to the angel, we see the humility of Gideon and the reason why God had selected him as the one to deliver Israel. We read in Judges 6:15 and 16, "And he said unto him, O my Lord, wherewith shall I save Israel? Behold, my family is poor in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house. Do you see why the Lord could use him? The Lord has no use for the proud and arrogant who glory in their own strength. He uses as his instruments those who realize their own nothingness and who consequently rely solely upon his strength. We continue with the 16th verse. And the Lord said unto him, Surely I will be with thee, and thou shalt smite the Midianites as one man. This reiteration of the fact that the Lord would indeed use him, in spite of his humble estate, interested Gideon very much. He begged the man of God to stay there under the oak until he could go and bring him a present. The man agreed. Gideon then hastened to his tent nearby and prepared a delicious meal of lamb and broth and unleavened bread and brought it to the man in a basket. Today we would call it a picnic basket. But the man did not eat the food. Instead, he told Gideon to put the meat and the bread upon a nearby rock and pour the broth over them. Then the man reached out with his staff and touched the food. Instantly, fire spurted out of the rock and burned up the meat, bread, and broth. When he saw this, Gideon realized that it was an angel of the Lord he had been talking to all the while, and he cried, Arise, O Lord God, alas, for now I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face. He was terrified. He was familiar with God's words to Moses in Exodus 33:20-23, There shall no man see me and live. My face shall not be seen. He thought that seeing an angel was equivalent to seeing God. But the angel reassured him, saying, Peace be unto thee. Fear not. Thou shalt not die. Then the angel disappeared. Gideon forgot all about his unfinished job of threshing. He immediately set about gathering stones and erected an altar upon the rock which had spurted fire. And because the angel had said, Peace be unto thee, he called it Jehovah Shalom, meaning Jehovah's peace. It appears that Gideon's father was one of the chief men of his tribe and district, and upon his plantation, high on a hilltop, in the midst of a consecrated grove, there had been erected a statue and an altar to Baal. The groves of Baal were not living trees, but consisted of huge posts or obelisks, very similar to the totem poles of the Eskimos. They were elaborately carved with figures and scenes depicting the supposed virtues and accomplishments of the idol. Gideon's father may have been in charge, or was the caretaker of this grove of Baal. The worship of Baal was obscene and licentious. It also involved the sacrifice of little children as burnt offerings, which thing was extremely displeasing to God. In 2 Kings 21:3-6, we read of one of the wicked kings of Israel. And he reared up altars for Baal, and made a grove, and he made his son pass through the fire. And of other wicked kings, it is written in Jeremiah 19:4-5, They have forsaken me, and have filled this place with the blood of innocents. They have built also the high places of Baal, to burn their sons with fire for burnt offerings unto Baal, which I commanded not, nor spake it, neither came it into my mind. And in 2 Chronicles 28:1-3, we read of wicked King Ahaz, who worshipped Baal, and he burnt his children in the fire after the abominations of the heathen. That very night the Lord spoke to Gideon again, this time in a dream. We read in Judges 6:25-26, And it came to pass the same night that the Lord said unto him, Take thy father's young bullock, even the second bullock of 7 years old, and throw down the altar of Baal that thy father hath, and cut down the grove that is by it. And build an altar unto the Lord thy God upon the top of this rock in the ordered place. And take the second bullock, and offer a burnt sacrifice with the wood of the grove which thou shalt cut down. It is interesting to note God's words to Gideon, referring to himself as the Lord thy God. This clearly indicates that Baal was not Gideon's God, that he was not in sympathy with his father's idolatry. But amidst all of that Baal worship, he had managed to cling to Jehovah, the true God of Israel. This command to Gideon to throw down the altar of Baal and cut down the grove was in strict accord with the original commandment of Deuteronomy 7:5, telling Israel how they must deal with idol worship. But thus shall ye deal with them. Ye shall destroy their altars and break down their images and cut down their groves and burn their graven images with fire. Their altars and images were to be utterly destroyed, and the groves of sacred totems or poles upon which were graven the exploits of the idol were to be cut down and burned. So this was not a new and strange commandment the Lord now gave to Gideon. It was an important part of the original law which Israel had agreed to keep, saying, as recorded in Exodus 19:8, "All that the Lord hath done, we will do." So it was simply a reminder to Gideon to carry out his responsibility as a loyal Israelite, something which should have been done by Israel as a matter of course long ago, but which had been shirked. And it was a forcible reminder of the reason why the Lord had permitted Israel to fall into the hands of Midian to be oppressed by them 7 years. But under the circumstances, it was a hard thing to ask Gideon to do. The altar of Baal was on his father's property, and his father was responsible for it. Defying his father's authority was bad enough, but he must also consider that the entire surrounding community was solidly composed of Baal worshippers, who would certainly resist any tampering with their idol. So obedience to the Lord meant the risk of his life. Gideon was willing to take that risk, but in doing so, he was as prudent as possible. He knew that if he openly attempted what the Lord had commanded, the priests of Baal and the men of the community would certainly prevent him from carrying it out. So he did his work at night. We read in Judges 6:27, "Then Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord had said unto him. And so it was, because he feared his father's household and the men of the city, that he could not do it by day, that he did it by night." Was this cowardly? Certainly not. He merely did not want his work to be interfered with. But he well knew that whether done by day or by night, he would still be held responsible for his deed and would have to take the consequences. And the priests of Baal were vicious men. They were human sacrificers. I am sure it must have crossed Gideon's mind that they might not only kill him, but after that they might even sacrifice his own children as burnt offerings to Baal. So there was nothing cowardly in what Gideon did. He was indeed, as the angel said, a man of valor. The fact that Gideon had 10 servants who were willing to help him desecrate Baal seems to indicate that his entire household may have consisted of faithful Israelites who still worshiped the true God, that Gideon had been attracting to himself and to his service those in Israel who abhorred Baal and clung to Jehovah. A 7-year-old bullock is not a calf, but an ox. At midnight, Gideon and his men harnessed this powerful animal and led it up the hill, atop of which stood the altar of Baal. The altar consisted of a huge, ugly, brazen image of the god with arms outstretched. It was hollow so that a roaring fire could be built inside it. When superheated, it was customary to sacrifice to it by throwing a little child into its arms to roast alive. The sheer weight of the idol made the ox necessary. It was too heavy to be moved by hand. Gideon quickly climbed the image and tied a rope around its neck. Attaching the other end to the harness of the ox, and assisted by his men, he pulled the idol down from its foundation so that it lay ignominiously upon its face in the dirt. Next, they gathered stones and erected an altar to the Lord upon the spot where the idol had stood. Then, lest the noise of chopping arouse the community, Gideon probably used the ox to also topple the grove of totem poles surrounding the idol. We can imagine a man climbing each one of the ornately carved poles and attaching a rope to its top. Then, descending, he would harness the ox to it and noiselessly pull it down. When the entire grove was thus leveled, the ox was probably used further to drag the huge poles to the newly made altar of Jehovah and lay them upon it. When all was in readiness, the wood was ignited, and the bullock offered upon the fire as a sacrifice to the Lord. As the flames fed by the dry poles consumed the sacrifice, Gideon and his men prostrated themselves before it in humble reverence to their God, and then quietly left the hill. Dawn was just breaking when the fire on the hill leaped skyward, lighting up the countryside. An early riser in the village saw it and gave the alarm. "Fire comes from the altar of Baal," he cried. "Our God is speaking to us." The men gathered themselves and hurried up the hill some distance away to see the miracle. But what they saw when they got there stunned and angered them. The sacred grove was gone, and upon the place where Baal had stood, they saw another altar, which they recognized as an altar to Jehovah, because it was built in austere simplicity, according to the specifications given in Exodus 20, 24 to 26. A brisk fire still burned upon it, consuming the last of the sacrifice. Scattered about the altar and still smoldering, they saw the charred ends of their totem poles. And before the altar, as though doing obeisance to it, flat upon his face in the dirt, was the great brazen image of Baal. They immediately suspected that Gideon was responsible for this outrage. It was probably well known that he did not worship Baal. But they made inquiries to be sure, because Gideon's father, Joash, was one of them and was their chief. They would not want to unjustly accuse his son. At this point, a witness must have come forward to say that Gideon and his servants had been absent from home that night, and that the second bullock of Joash, to which Gideon had access, was missing. We now read from the account in Judges 6, 28 and 29. "And when the men of the city arose early in the morning, behold, the altar of Baal was cast down, and the grove was cut down that was by it, and the second bullock was offered upon the altar that was built. And they said one to another, 'Who hath done this thing?' And when they inquired and asked, they said, 'Gideon, the son of Joash, hath done this thing.'" The idolaters armed themselves and went in a body to the house of Joash, where Gideon had taken refuge. Meanwhile, Joash had talked with his son Gideon regarding his exploits of the night and had come to some definite conclusions. Joash now came out and boldly faced the mob. We continue with the 30th and 31st verses. "Then the men of the city said unto Joash, 'Bring out thy son that he may die, because he hath cast down the altar of Baal, and because he hath cut down the grove that was by it. And Joash said unto all that stood against him, Will ye plead for Baal? Will ye save him? He that will plead for him, let him be put to death whilst it is yet morning. If he be a god, let him plead for himself, because one hath cast down his altar. Do you see what a powerful argument this was that Joash used? There stood the supposedly mighty Baal, surrounded by a veritable forest of poles, upon which were engraved the scenes of his reputed great accomplishments and virtues. Along comes a puny man with a cow and pulls down the whole business. And the mighty Baal is powerless to prevent it. So Joash told them, Now if Baal cannot fight for himself, but has to depend upon you to defend him, he isn't much of a god, is he? Do you still believe in him? If so, perhaps Baal requires a human sacrifice to expiate what has happened to his altar. If you are so eager to plead for him, how about offering yourself to die? Let anyone here who pleads the cause of Baal be put to death this very morning. At this, the ferocity of the mob quickly cooled. One by one, they slunk away. From his performance, I think we can safely assume that Joash had been, then and there, converted to the worship of Jehovah. The news of what Gideon had done spread like wildfire throughout Israel. It showed them that Baal was a false god, that he was powerless against the God of Gideon, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the true God of their fathers. The people woke up to the fact that their idolatry was really the cause of all their troubles. As a result, there was a great conversion in Israel, and there was a determination to throw off the yoke of Midian. All they needed now was an effective leadership, and Gideon provided that leadership. With only 300 men, carefully selected according to the Lord's direction, he put to rout 135,000 of the host of Midian and freed Israel from their yoke. But that is another story. Now let us see what further lessons we can learn from this account. First of all, there is a lesson with respect to idolatry. An idolatrous natural Israel had its groves of totem poles carved with intricate imaginations. So nominal spiritual Israel today have for their totem poles the various denominational creeds to which men give veneration. And the monstrous Baal is still worshipped in nominal Christendom today. Although we do not have a literal Baal of brass, heated red hot and with arms extended to receive little children into its fiery embrace, we do have instead a Baal of a much larger scale. A blasphemous misrepresentation of the only true God. Today we have a super Baal, not one who is content with an occasional human burnt offering, but a God red hot with the flames of hell and purgatory, with millions agonizing in his embrace eternally. But this Baal, this horrible misconception of a loving and merciful God, will be toppled and laid in the dust by the great antitypical Gideon, Christ Jesus, who will also cut down and destroy the creed totem poles of Christendom. But there is a more subtle and serious form of idolatry which threatens the Lord's people, true spiritual Israel. The very first commandment of the Decalogue was, as given in Exodus 20:3-5, Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God. This commandment was amplified in Deuteronomy 6, 4, and 5. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy might. Of course, none of the Lord's true people are guilty of idolatry in the sense of worshiping graven images of wood, metal, and stone. But anything which is loved more than God, which is exalted above God in the mind, is an idol. One's own self can be an idol. In many respects, this idol of self is the most horrible one of all, the meanest looking. But most of the friends do not idolize self or wealth, ambition, and fame. And we do not value too highly the possession of beautiful homes, automobiles, expensive jewelry, and fine clothing, as the world does. I am sure we know enough not to do that. But there is another danger. Because of the very unselfish love which a Christian life engenders, we may set undue affections upon wife, husband, parent, child, brother, or sister. Jesus saw this danger and said in Matthew 10:37, He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Again, he said in Luke 14:26, If any man come to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. Hate, as here used, does not mean to detest. According to other translations, it simply means to love less. We are indeed to love our families. We are to love them very much. Are we not told in Ephesians 5:25, Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church? Did not Christ love the church very much? And Matthew 19:19 says, To honor thy father and thy mother, and thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Also we read in 1 John 4:20, If a man say, I love God, and hateth his brother, he is a liar. So it is not a matter of ceasing to love our families, or loving them any less than we do, but of loving God and Christ even more than these. As the poet expresses it, 'Tis written, Keep yourselves from idols. How shall I obey? Oh, not by loving less, but by loving more. It is not that we love our precious ones too much, but God too little. But as a practical matter, how can we increase our love for God? How can we attain that ideal given in Mark 12:30 of loving God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength? There is no better way than to contemplate, meditate, and study the plan of God, and to cooperate with it. It is a wonderful and flawless plan. It is the perfect solution to all the problems of humankind. It answers every question and soothes every fear. It is wise, just, and loving. The more we realize and appreciate its beauty and grandeur, the more we will love the author of that plan. We will grow in love for God. We are bound to do so. Additionally, we can increase our love for God by reminding ourselves and tracing God's wonderful providences in our lives, how he has drawn us and called us and lovingly led us all the way. We can remember all of his exceeding great and precious promises to us, which are so sure of fulfillment. It is in these ways that our love for God will grow and excel and surpass all earthly loves. And if you love God, tell him so. Express your longing in every prayer you make. Say to him, Lord, I love thee. David, the beloved of God, did this with beauty of expression in Psalm 42:1-2. As the hart panteth after the water brooks, so panteth my soul after thee, O God. My soul thirsteth for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God? Our love for God should be so fervent that this cry of David should be also our own longing and aspiration. Although our love for God is spontaneous and not for reward, nevertheless the Lord does abundantly bless those who love Him here and hereafter. We read in 1 Corinthians 2:9, "As it is written, eye hath not seen, nor ear heard, neither have entered into the heart of man the things which God hath prepared for them that love Him." And that most precious text, Romans 8:28. We know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to His purpose. And we must prove our love for God before we are found worthy. Deuteronomy 13:3 applies to us. "The Lord your God proveth you to know whether ye love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul." And let us not forget that there were material blessings promised to Israel if they would refrain from idolatry. As spiritual Israel, we are the heirs of the spiritual counterparts of those blessings. The Lord promised them rain in due season. We are promised and have abundantly received showers of truth, meat in due season. Israel was promised that their land would yield her increase and their trees much fruit. We bring forth the fruits and graces of the Holy Spirit. As Jesus said in John 4:36, "He that reapeth receiveth wages and gathereth fruit unto life eternal." Israel was promised a good vintage and bread to the full. We have the wine of the communion of the blood of Christ. And we do indeed eat bread to the full. We partake of Christ, as it is written in John 6:35. Jesus said unto them, "I am the bread of life. He that cometh to me shall never hunger, and he that believeth on me shall never thirst." And for their obedience, the Lord promised Israel peace and safety and freedom from fear. Spiritual Israel has the peace of God which passeth all understanding. And our freedom from fear in a troubled world is expressed in Psalm 46, 1-3. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore will not we fear, though the earth be removed and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof. It was so frustrating and disheartening to Israel when the Midianites laid in wait and then swooped down and took away their produce for which they had worked so hard. They had to start all over again. Similarly, it sometimes seems that when we have managed to make a little headway in developing the fruits and graces of Christian character, the enemy comes in like a flood and undoes all our work. This can be very discouraging. At such times, let us remember Proverbs 24:15-16. "Lay not wait, O wicked one, against the dwelling of the righteous. Spoil not his resting place. For a just man falleth seven times and riseth up again." It's not how many times you fall that counts, but how many times you get up. So let us say, as is written in Micah 7:8, "Rejoice not against me, O mine enemy. When I fall, I shall arise." Let us remember that in the prize ring, a fighter is counted out only if he stays down. We note that the Midianites robbed and plundered Israel at their harvest time, depriving them of the food they had so laboriously acquired. I think this is significant. Are there some today who would take away the harvest truths which we have found so satisfying? Some who would rob us of our spiritual food and leave us impoverished? Such plundering must be vigorously resisted if we would maintain our spiritual lives. Gideon didn't look much like a mighty man of valor when he hid himself in the winepress to thresh wheat. But that's what the angel called him. Let us learn from this that it is our potential that God sees when he calls us. Not what we are, but what we can be. If he has called you to run for the prize of the high calling, he knows that you can do it with his grace to help. And as he instructed and guided Gideon in everything, he will do the same for you. His words to Gideon, "Surely I will be with thee. Have I not sent thee?" apply with equal force to you. You will remember that the Lord said to Gideon in Judges 6:25, "Take thy father's young bullock, even the second bullock of 7 years old, and throw down the altar of Baal." And then this second bullock was to be offered as a sacrifice. This has a wonderful significance. Adam was the Heavenly Father's first bullock, the first perfect man, who forfeited his life through disobedience. Jesus was the Father's second bullock, the second perfect man, the number 7 signifying perfection. The burnt sacrifice of the second bullock corresponds to the sacrifice of the bullock of the tabernacle. The second bullock was also the ransom sacrifice. Thus we read in 1 Corinthians 15:45-47, "The first man, Adam, was made a living soul. The last Adam was made a quickening spirit. The first man is of the earth earthy. The second man is the Lord from heaven." When the result of this ransom sacrifice is applied to the world during the millennium, then the antitypical altar of Baal, Satan the devil, who has so long oppressed the world, will be overthrown and the worship of the true God restored. So we can see that this account of Gideon also, as in so many others in the Bible, contains an outline of the entire divine plan from the fall of man to his restoration. Gideon, of course, was a type of Christ. There are many correspondences. The scriptures indicate that Gideon was of a princely appearance, that he had a look of nobility and resembled the child of a king. Of Jesus it was written in Luke 1:32, "He shall be great and shall be called the Son of the Highest, and the Lord God shall give unto him the throne of his father David." Gideon was told in Judges 6:16, "Thou shalt smite the Midianites as one man." Similarly, it is through the performance of one man, Jesus Christ, that Satan will be smitten and his oppressive rule over mankind ended. Thus we read in Romans 5:12-19, "As by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. For if through the offense of one many be dead, much more the grace of God and the gift by grace, which is by one man, Jesus Christ, hath abounded unto many. For as by one man's disobedience many were made sinners, so by the obedience of one shall many be made righteous." We find that Gideon promptly obeyed the Lord's command to destroy the altar of Baal, but that he exercised prudence in so doing. He did it at night to prevent interference. We too can be prudent in our service. We can give our witness to the world and demolish false doctrines in such a way as not to unnecessarily antagonize others, thus preventing premature interference with our work. We know, according to John 9:4, that the night cometh when no man can work. But let us not precipitate that time. Jesus was similarly prudent. Although he was not afraid of the scribes and Pharisees, he avoided unnecessary confrontation with them until his time had come. We read in John 10:39 and 40, "Therefore they sought again to take him, but he escaped out of their hand and went away beyond Jordan." This was not cowardly, but prudent. In obeying the call of the Lord, Gideon risked his life, his family, and everything he had, not knowing how he would be delivered from the wrath of the idolaters, or whether he would be delivered at all. He promptly carried out the Lord's will. And when he had removed the altar of Baal, he erected another altar there and offered an acceptable sacrifice to God. This is a good picture of consecration. Removing every trace of Baal worship from our hearts, renouncing every earthly idol, and raising God to a supreme position in our lives, we present our bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God. The name Midian means strife or contention. This is what Israel of old suffered. Is there strife and contention in the church today? Israel got into difficulty when they turned away from the true teachings of God. Is the strife in the church today caused by departures from the truth, as the Lord revealed it to us through his wise and faithful servant? This is something to think about. Then finally, there is an intimate and personal lesson to be learned from this account. If the Lord ever seems to have turned his face from you, as he did from Israel, if you feel spiritually oppressed and impoverished, if you have lost much of the zestful appreciation of the truth which you once enjoyed, perhaps Midian is robbing you too. Just as Israel was enticed into idolatry and so lost the Lord's favor for a while, perhaps you have allowed some person or thing to become too highly exalted in your life, to become a stronghold of Baal to you. If this is the case, prompt and vigorous action is necessary. A warfare is required. And as God sent Gideon to deliver Israel, he will make his mighty power available to you through the antitypical Gideon, Jesus Christ. Thus it is written in 2 Corinthians 10:4 and 5, "The weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ." And if you do this, you will be restored to God's full favor and blessing.